period from the election to your appointment as ambassador, as much as we can cover. First of all, on your Vietnamese effort as background to your China trip, and then how that came about, and then how it came about that you were appointed ambassador. Sure. You mentioned in our last session that you had indicated soon after the election that you would not be interested in leaving the UAW prior to the natural termination of your association with the UAW. And second, you mentioned that you would not be interested in a domestic position such as Secretary of HEW. At what point did you begin to indicate some interest in international affairs, and do you know how you were selected for this mission to Vietnam?
I had communicated not too long after the election a specific reference to HEW that I did not want to be considered for that, and that I was going to serve out my term as president of the UAW, which ran until May of 1977, and there was no other reference in that connection. I met with Governor Carter and Senator Mondale, President and Vice President-elect, at Blair House on Thursday, December 9. And my purpose there was to discuss the UAW and my personal recommendations for cabinet posts and other things. There was no discussion at all of myself, nor was there any concern in my mind as to what would happen. As a matter of fact, sometime in January of 1977, I don't even remember whether it was before or after the inaugural on the 20th of January, I think it was before. May have been after. I was asked by Secretary Vance to serve on the Ambassadorial Advisory Commission, which I accepted, so that I had absolutely no thought of being involved in any ambassadorial role.
Had you known Secretary Vance before that time?
Yes, I knew him when he was in the Defense Department. As a matter of fact, when he was deputy, I think he was Deputy Secretary of Defense. I had some direct involvement with him over a negotiation and strike situation in a plant making helicopters, very much needed in Vietnam. It was a little controversial, but I
were you on opposite sides of the fence at that point?
To a degree, because I took the reaction that the thought seemed to be that the only thing needed was to put the people back to work, keep them at work, because the engines were needed, and forget about the problems and the contract that they had. This was at the end, close to the end of a 80-day cooling-off period injunction, which had been obtained by the government under the Taft-Hartley Act. Things came out well and satisfactorily, and out of it we I think, got a liking for each other. So I accepted on this ambassadorial advisory commission and went to the first meeting of that commission on the 4th of February, 1977, in the White House. The meeting started at 9:30. Governor Askew of Florida was our chairman. Abel Harriman was on it. Dean Rusk was on it. Those were 25 or 30 of us. We first met with the president, and then he left. And then Secretary Vance was there, and he spoke to us, and he left. Then we were told a very stiff agenda we had ahead of us, that there were all these posts to be, ambassadorial posts to be considered, and it would, this commission would have to meet 2, maybe 3 days a week for the next several weeks. And I sat there and listened to this and thought to myself, my gosh, this is absolutely impossible for me, because I had to come in from Detroit, and it meant, unless the times meshed very well, it meant an additional day for that purpose. And I just couldn't do justice to it, because we were getting ready for my final convention. Plus, we had two big controversial issues on the Hill, the one legislation involving emission controls for automobiles and fuel economy miles per hour standards, in which I was personally and heavily involved. So I say to myself, I've just got to get off. I've just got to get off this commission. After I'd said this to myself, then a senior staff member who was going through all of this says, now, everyone should know that if you serve on this commission, you cannot be considered for an ambassadorial appointment until 2 years after you have resigned from the commission, or the commission has been terminated. And I thought, the only reaction to that was, this is a little embarrassing. Then the meeting broke up. We met in the cabinet room, and we were supposed to go to the State Department for lunch and to resume further discussion at the department in the afternoon. In any event, I couldn't have gone to the I couldn't have gone in the afternoon, because that same afternoon we along with the executives from the four automobile companies, late in the afternoon, had a meeting with President Carter on the auto emissions problem. I had a meeting before that with David Rigoni, who was then dean of the engineering school at Michigan, and who was our advisor on the technical questions involved. I might say, an unpaid, but his insistence, advisor. But he was extremely useful to us, because he's one of the top authorities in the field. And that was just an example of how I couldn't have done this job. So as the meeting breaks up, I seek out Governor Askew to explain to him my problem, to say to him, look, I have no idea of being an ambassador, so that's not why I'm getting off. I'm just getting off because I can't do the job. And I also talked to him about having Steve Schlossberg, who was our legal counsel, but resident in Washington, taking my place, because commission was not all of one mind by any means, and I wanted somebody of my general viewpoints to sit in on making these recommendations. Well, Reuben Askew, he and I knew each other quite well, he starts to argue with me very vehemently that this was so important I should put other things aside and concentrate on this, and I'm just telling him it's absolutely impossible. We're the only two left in the room. Cy Vance comes through the door, and he wants to know what we're arguing about. So I tell him, and he just says, Leonard's right. He can't serve under these circumstances. He can't serve. And then he said, if you'd excuse us, there's something I need to talk to him about. And it was then he told me that the president wanted me to head up the presidential commission to go to Hanoi to take up the question of missing in action and related matters. He said the president wants to name you first and then name the rest of the members of the commission about a week later. He did indicate to me that who he hoped would be on the commission, including Mike Mansfield and Charles Yost.
Sonny Montgomery,
who had shown a lot of courage in heading up the congressional committee,
right,
which did some very, very good work on this question, and Marion Edelman. So we talked about it, and I said, okay, yes. And a few days later, that was announced. I wondered afterwards why I was asked to serve on the, I guess it was just two different staffs at work, because it didn't make much sense to ask me to serve on that commission at the same time have in mind that we should go very quickly to what was originally scheduled to be Hanoi and Vientiane and also Phnom Penh. I learned subsequently that the president had been told that Mike Mansfield wouldn't serve under somebody else. He had to be chairman or it would be impossible to get him. And in fact, I think my information was the secretary said that to the president. But the president said that no, he wanted me, and that was that. I think that's why the announcement of the chairman and the balance of the members was separated by a few days. Well, of course, Mike Mansfield had been close for a long time, and there was absolutely no problem in that regard. In fact, he was in the work of the commission. Mike was worth his weight in gold. When there'd be some, we didn't have many arguments, but on two or three occasions when there'd be little arguments, he would say, "Well, you've heard the chairman." That would be the end of it. So we went to Hanoi, of course. The work on getting ready began almost immediately. At the same time, I'm having all sorts of meetings to try and have our secondary leadership in the UAW understand that a quite complex situation involving emissions. And why why this political effort was so necessary and for them to be following through with their own representatives and their senators and so on. At the same time, I was having meetings myself with members of the Congress, and I was working closely with Ed Muskie, who did not see the problem the way I saw it, with John Dingell, who did. I discovered in all of that that John Dingell and Ed Muskie didn't think very much of each other. The Polish caucus wasn't working very well. And of course, this issue was in several different subcommittees, so that you had to touch an awful lot of bases. And I was really extremely busy. But then in addition to that, our convention, which was scheduled for May, was preliminary work, and particularly political preliminary work, because I was stepping out as president. And we had some political, interpolitical things to take care of. So the work in the State Department, the commission name, began by towards the end of
February.
Towards the end of February, right. We had meetings with the various groups involved, like
the League
of Families, and the veterans organizations. I was very glad that we met with the League of Families. We met with the Friends Service Committee. We met with Richard Dudman, who'd himself been held in Cambodia. And
from the White House perspective, I was the NSC staff person tried at least brief particular mission. And our issue at that point was also who to include in that delegation. There was a great deal of political jockeying over the membership of the committee, how many people were to go from the Congress, whether there was to be one member from each, the House and the Senate, or whether there'd have to be Republican and Democrat from each, the bipartisan nature of it. And then also whether the League was to be represented. They very much wanted to have one of their people on the delegation.
That I didn't know.
They made a great effort, and there was one Colonel Hopper, who was the head of the League. He wanted to go, and we had to say no, because we were uncertain that, in fact, they would be able to behave themselves.
Well, they were too much of an advocate to have served usefully on that commission, I think.
That's right.
But the commission that was chosen was really an excellent one. And from the very beginning, we worked together in great harmony. So that we had our first get together on the 28th of February, and we left Andrews Air Force Base on the 13th of March, so that within less than 2 weeks, all of that preparatory work was done. We also had excellent staff that went with us.
Yeah. Now, to what extent did you sense on that mission that your purpose was limited to the MIA issue and the recovery of remains and discovery of whether there were additional MIAs in the Indochina states? And to what extent was your private intent, as you recall it, to use this issue as a bridge to begin the process of restoring relations between Vietnam and the United States?
Well, as I understood it, and I think pretty much as the members of the commission understood it, the Vietnamese, in effect, were saying, "Okay, we'll cooperate with you and find your dad and ship back their remains if you carry out the commitment made to us by President Nixon and Secretary Kissinger with the famous letter."
Reparations.
They're being willing to pay the reparations. And, of course, that, as you remember, was sitting very badly with the American people. So that our effort was also directed to separating these issues, to getting the Vietnamese to be willing to address in a legitimate fashion the MIA question, and to separate out certainly the question of reparations or aid in any form, and in that way, obviously, to lay the basis for additional diplomatic efforts, mm-hmm. which could go ultimately to the normalization of relations.
Yes, my own view is that, first, a background as to why this is, in my view, an interesting and important question. There was, throughout the Carter administration, an intertwining of American relations toward Vietnam and toward China. And I have often wondered in my own mind as to whether Secretary Vance and Dick Holbrooke had some thought at the outset to really move very rapidly on improving relations with Vietnam, even before they had addressed the issue of how they were to move forward in relations with China. I've never quite understood why the MIA issue was given such prominence as one of the first of our moves in Asia, the second of those moves obviously being the Korean troop withdrawal issue. From my vantage point, as a newcomer to Washington, I didn't know quite how to handle these two initiatives, but I felt that somehow we were getting things out of kilter at the outset, and that we should have looked at Korea, China, Vietnam in some integrated pattern. But I saw the move toward Vietnam as irresistible in the sense that there was a broad support for looking at the MIA issue, and I don't know whether that was really the intent or whether there was this unwritten part of the agenda that Secretary Vance also had in mind.
Well, I honestly don't know. At the time, as you know, I was no China specialist.
Right.
And I had a very considerable interest in East Asia in particular, but not China as such. And I took at face value that this question of the MIAs was a troublesome one. And if some progress could have been made on it, something out of which political capital would flow.
Mm-hmm.
But had I been looking, as I did a few months later, at the larger picture, I may have thought differently about it, because it did seem that when we came back with what was described as being a successful mission, that the belief was that we could move quickly to normalization of relations. Now, had that been posed to me at that time, I would not have reacted negatively.
Mm-hmm.
Although, when I was in fact sitting in Peking, I used to worry that we'd move too fast with Vietnam to make the move to China.
Of course, at that
almost
time,
impossible.
Yeah, of course, at that time, Sino-Vietnamese relations had not yet deteriorated, but. So that in early 77, one didn't have to think one was choosing between having good relations with one or the other, but nonetheless, the question was whether we weren't dealing with peripheral issues rather than central issues at the outset.
Right.
The other point, though, that is worth noting on the record is that President Carter had personally pledged that soon after coming into office, he would address the MIA issue. And his first set of moves was really tied to his campaign promises, so that the question was not whether he was going to address that issue. That was almost a given in those early days of the Carter administration, but rather how he was to address it and whether addressing that issue necessitated a commission of the distinction that he ultimately sent. Were you at all involved then in thinking through why the commission, presidential commission format, was the appropriate one, or?
No. At the point I was approached early in February by Secretary Vance, the decisions were all made.
Uh-huh. So, well, that's something that I want to pursue in some of the other interviewing. I think I have, by the way, looked at some of Zbigniew's memoirs, and they don't address the issue of what happened from the election to early January in terms of setting priorities, and yet so much of the administration in its first year was reflective of decisions taken between the election and early January. I can't quite understand where those decisions were made or how they were made.
You say that the relations between China and Vietnam in 77 hadn't they already cooled?
Cooled, but were not yet strained. It was not clear that one had to choose between having a good relationship with one or the other. There were signs of strain, to be sure, but as I recollect, and my memory may be imperfect here, the profound downturn in their relations only occurred later in the year.
Later in the year of
77,
yeah. Because I remember, and I forget when, but I was already in Peking. Well, it could have been even in 78. But Stanley Carnot wrote a critical piece about me. Been earlier, but the one who had been to Hanoi and was received in friendly fashion would not be welcome in Peking. It was before I went, I guess. It wasn't Carnot, it was someone else. So that would have been in the summer of 77.
But you will remember that on Secretary Vance's trip, we indicated to the Chinese our desire to normalize relations with Vietnam, and it did not elicit a blast. But, and in fact, the Chinese did not speak much about Indochina during the Vance visit. However, on the Brzezinski visit, which we will come to in these interviews, one of the major Chinese presentations was on Vietnam, and it took us somewhat by surprise. We had not anticipated the vehemence with which the Chinese would center on the Vietnamese issue. Well,
I know in this regard, when we were in Hanoi, we were there so briefly that wasn't much time for anything besides the meetings and the necessary social events. But they did take us to their National History Museum, and with particular reference to how they had repelled the Chinese at key points in their history. Of course, they did take pains to say these were the Chinese feudalists, but I don't think it was something that they would have done with such a commission if they hadn't had already some considerable feeling in the matter.
Well, I think the omens or the portents were there, and indeed one could argue that Sino-Vietnamese tensions existed throughout the 1970s. The invitation of Kissinger was of great concern to the Vietnamese, and then the Chinese did exert pressure on the Vietnamese to come to terms with the United States. The Chinese also, the evidence suggests, discouraged the 1975 attack on the South, so that their perspectives were different from an early date. But we digress. But my main sense, I was just trying to get, is how much did you have a sense at the time of the mission as to whether there was this larger purpose to it? You will remember that you came back from that mission and gave a report to the president in the cabinet room. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And then afterward, as I recall, both you and President Carter had a press conference.
That's right.
There was a press release, so that's all available on the public record. How do you look back on that mission? And you say that it was called a success. Did it achieve what you had hoped to set out to accomplish?
Well, as I say, we thought that central to our mission was to get the Vietnamese to separate the question of missing in action and
mm-hmm.
be willing to pursue that problem
right.
from our other relationships. Obviously, we were in no way sympathetic to any notion of reparations. And they did not dwell on the treaty. Had been violated by both sides in any event, so that our position was it's a nullity, there's no point to talking about it. I think that in that respect, yes, that we did accomplish our purpose. I might say that we had supposedly worked out in advance what would happen, whom we would see, and so on. The first good omen was when we were met at the airport by Vice Foreign Minister Phan Hien. We had expected that it would just be someone from the ministry there, and we'd be taken in. Which I guess was the way that Sonny Montgomery's congressional group had been handled. They took us down to the government guest house, which was new. But then we were ushered into a meeting with Trim. Foreign Minister, yes. And he carried out the old line very, very strongly. And I remember saying to him, of course, and this was something for which we were entirely unprepared, and I said to him that that we had not come halfway around the world to engage in sterile propaganda, that we were here for a serious purpose and to try and reach a better understanding. And he didn't pursue that. That came towards the end of our meeting, which in traditional way he had a long presentation, to which I had a relatively brief response and a sharp response as was needed under the circumstance. Because of that beginning, Commission had a meeting, and I think this was probably prompted by Mike Mansfield, in which they said to me that if we ran into a stone wall, since we had so little time, that I was authorized to ask for an off-the-record one-on-one meeting between myself and Fong Yan. And it was the foreign minister, and Nguyen Z. Trinh, Nguyen Duy Trinh. Vice Premier and Foreign Minister. What I said to him was that after he put out their standard position that we come in a spirit of equality between two free independent nations. We have two different political and social systems. And within our system, we have a new national leader, Jimmy Carter, our first president in the post-war period. We have not come here for purposes of creating a sterile polemical discussion. We hope that in the course of these discussions, you will come to understand political difficulties on the American side. In this third century of our nation, we have a new political beginning. Our hope is that through these discussions, we will create conditions that will lead to mutual benefit. And his only response was, is the program of activity is good? Which said something about how far, how many hours away, and so on. So that we met our commission met with Van Hien on the morning of the 17th of March. And I gave the American statement as prepared, ready for the meeting. And he responded again at length and in standard fashion. He had said that about the great devastation that the war had brought to Vietnam, both North and South, and what had been left behind. He spoke about 400,000 prostitutes, 100,000 drug addicts, and so on, and spoke about the 4-point policy of peaceful coexistence.
Was this a prepared statement, or did he just read it extemporaneously?
No,
or
this, mean was, it was just this was prepared. This was prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And this was all of the initial part was with in a global context, not necessarily bilateral. He then went to he then addressed U.S.-Vietnam relations.
Mm-hmm.
And addressing, among other things, the U.S. responsibility, as he called it, to contribute to the post-war reconstruction of Vietnam, the reparations question. He said it was in three aspects, the legal aspect, the other matters, and then quoted from the letter that in regard to other forms of aid, the U.S. indicates that the appropriate programs could fall in the range of $1 billion to $1.5 billion, depending on food and other commodity needs. And this is besides the $3.25 billion, which was supposedly committed by Article 21 of the treaty. I want to know, did we know about this, about the letter as well as the treaty? And I said, yes, we knew about it.
At that point, the letter had not yet been made public, had it?
No.
And who had briefed you about the letter? That was done in the State Department.
That was done in the State Department before we left.
And who, do you remember who did that?
A rotating group of people. I think
Bruce Oakley, maybe, must have been involved in preparing you for that trip.
Oakley, it wasn't. His
no,
name wasn't
Deputy
Bruce.
Assistant Secretary. Do you remember Bruce?
Was his name Bruce? Oakley.
Yeah.
So I remember his name is Bruce. Oakley.
Oakley, was it not Bill?
Oakley was senior.
Person. Yeah, he was the senior deputy. Not Bruce. Bruce was a college mate of mine. His name was Bruce. Bill. Well, in any case, but Oakley was the
Oakley,
key guy.
Right.
Very capable person.
Yes. And they'd also, of course, sprung it on Montgomery and his group in an earlier time so that Sonny was aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He,
Bill Oakley, maybe.
Not Bill, anyway. It's Oakley. That was sure of.
Bob.
And
Try Bob.